Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Felicia.
My name is Julia. We're sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
Kai'ulani, the People's Princess, Hawaii, 1889. This one is by Ellen Emerson White. Follows the life of Victoria Kai'ulani Cleghorn from 1889 to 1893 as she studies to be a better princess, even as Hawaii's monarchy and her throne are being undermined by American businessmen. That is the understatement summary of the century.
I was going to say, that's a really nice way to go and talk about American imperialists are doing their thing, as always, for the gain of capitalism.
For sure. So, forgiveness in advance for the mispronunciation of Hawaii names. Not meaning to be disrespectful, trying to do my best.
Same. I mean, legit. I mean,
that's my biggest caveat.
We're all doing our best.
So Princess Kai'ulani is an important person in the history of Hawaii, but not necessarily because of the things she accomplished. She never got to be a ruler, so we can't look at her political career. And the circumstances and sadness surrounding her death have seemed to gain more attention than any other details of her life. But her story is important because for a lot of people, it's the catalyst to learn more about the nation of Hawaii that was formed and then taken over by the U.S. This was a huge I never knew thing that came up when I was first reading this book. So tell me about your feelings about this book when you read it the first time, and how do you feel about it now rereading it?
Well, I just want to say that the first line, which is, "It is a new year, and yet I am terribly sad," that really set the tone.
Yes.
I remember thinking that I enjoyed this book a lot when I first read it, and I think I enjoyed it more on reading it now, because I do have more historical background knowledge. I've grown up in my own personal politics and everything like that, and I think that it really, for somebody who, I think, to your point, we don't really talk about her outside of her death. Mm-hmm. And, like, her lost potential. I thought that this was a really well-drawn and fulsome portrait of a young woman.
Yeah, and you know how sometimes we like to, you know, how much of what's in this book is true, how much is, like, exaggerated or things like that. Mm-hmm. When I was going to give you sort of a crash course into who's the real Kai'ulani, I would have been repeating much of what is already in this book.
Yeah.
That's how well done it is historically wise. So mm-hmm. if you look up any sort of I want a bio on this person, this book actually, in my opinion, cuts the mustard.
Dang.
So that's why when I'm going to be sharing with you about this, it's not going to be a lot of it focused on her, because I feel like in the book, the takedown of Hawaii, it's very sudden because it's from what happened to her in real life, which is she gets 3 telegrams, your life is over, this is done. But there's a lot more, obviously, behind the scenes while mm-hmm. she's away in England being educated to become a proper princess, which is its own kettle of fish there.
Yeah.
There are a lot of factors that led to the political overthrow of the monarchy that no one could have added up to see coming, but it's systemic. From the time that Hawaii was recognized as a formal nation, it was almost like its undoing was written in its, you know what I mean? Like, I its past is already written its future kind of thing.
I think also, too, it's we're both, even though the irony of irony is that we're reading princess books, we're both not the biggest fans of monarchies as systems at all.
Systems of governance, they don't, there's a lot of negatives to them, frankly. And it just, they don't, for someone who I personally, I'm a big fan of meritocracy. Like, that's how I like to operate. So a monarchy is the antithesis of a meritocracy. If you are born to a position, but you actually have the capabilities of doing the job, you go for it. But if you are just showing up because I am born of the son or the daughter of so-and-so, that doesn't cut the mustard for me for being a good ruler.
Yeah. And you know me, I am not I'm not a monarchist at all. However, the thing is, so what makes me always sad about Hawaii whenever I think about its history and like its current politics is that, especially for like the indigenous Hawaiians too, mm-hmm. is that they were doing the proper thing that you were supposed to go and do, quote unquote, to be seen as a legitimate nation. But because they were not white Europeans, and again, because they had goods and other products that basically could be exploited for capital, that wasn't acceptable.
Yeah, because I'll totally bring that up. There's a lot to unpack about the idea of what makes a nation, who counts as being Hawaiian, mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a legitimate government? I have ideas about this now that I didn't have as a kid, obviously. Mm-hmm. And obviously this will change too, probably over time. But I remember when I was a child reading this, and if you're like me and you're raised in a Western country and you think of, you know, this is a legitimate form of government, you have a recognized king or queen on the throne. The people are in agreement about it. They have a constitution. They have the pomp and circumstance. They have a palace. They have all these trappings of being a real monarchy government, everything.
They had like an actual legislation and everything
like that. The idea that you could show up and say, I don't think this is legitimate. Now, this is something that when we're conquering into nations, because I don't understand your form of government, therefore you don't have one, I will make you have mine. Well, they had the one that all Western nations did recognize.
Yeah.
And that the fact that they were like, I guess it's not real enough, or it doesn't count enough. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm like, excuse me.
Yeah,
like,
Even
as a small child, that rubbed me the wrong way. So, any more thoughts about this book? Characterization of her, she was very trying to sort of keep a stiff upper lip, even though it's she gets taken from her home and then she has to go to boarding school and she's isolated and then all this stuff with the annexation starts petering out.
Over half of the book is spent with her being in Hawaii. She has her actual in real life friendship with Robert Louis Stevenson,
which I would like to tell you that I was so concerned about that friendship. Really? Upon rereading this book, I was like, please tell me nothing terrible happened. So I had to do a deep dive into Robert Louis Stevenson
to find out if he was a perv,
to find out if he was Lewis Carroll, you're hanging out with Alice in Wonderland too much kind of nasty dude. Ugh. Thankfully, Robert Louis Stevenson is an upright standing gentleman. He's an upright standing gentleman. He stood upright and he's an upstanding gentleman.
Oh my God.
So he's a good dude. And yeah. I'll do an extra little bit of blurby thing about him at another point. But I had to go down to that. Please tell me this guy was cool.
And I know, not a right? creep.
Because he was very sweet to her.
I know.
Because what it's cute is that her mother's dead, so she's sort of playing lady of the house, even though she's 12 years old.
13 something.
And he's very respectful, you know, writing her a letter. You know, she's graciously inviting him to the family house for dinner, because that's what you do as the lady of the house.
Yep.
And instead of, you know, bypassing her and talking straight to the dad, my family and I would be happy to accept your invitation for tea kind of thing.
He's one of the good people who actually takes children or like teenagers seriously. Mm-hmm. And that's always makes you cool in my books.
Yeah.
So yeah, going back to the structure of the book, just over half of it is her being in Hawaii. And then we go her traveling and then she's in England. And then it's very rush and very sudden at the end, mm-hmm. which I guess is trying to go and set a bit of an emotional tone too as well. So then you're sort of, whoa, what the hell happened?
Yeah.
That both on one hand is a positive, but it also is a little bit of a negative too as well.
Well, because the way it comes across in the book is that it just was almost someone decided to wake up and be like, I think I'll take over Hawaii.
I know, right?
Which wasn't how it was going down at all. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and obviously because she's a child and maybe, you know, people aren't telling her what's actually happening in terms of the government and mm-hmm. these plantation owners and things like that. It's understandable that she wouldn't be recording that in her quote unquote diary.
Yeah.
But for you as the reader, and then you're just, wait, what?
Exactly.
So hopefully I'll be able to give a little bit more backstory so you'll understand how the heck did this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting too, the deep, deep rabbit holes you can go about, you know, how Hawaii was stolen. And you have the weirdest things about people who are about individual rights versus states' rights versus this right. It's quite a maze. So
oh God.
Be very warned. If you see there's a documentary called Stealing Hawaii, one of the main talking heads is this guy who renounced his U.S. citizenship in protest. And you think, whoa, that's pretty radical. This guy's an anarchist. But then you find out that he's actually down with white supremacist groups and like think he's friends with David Duke or something horrible. And you're just like, what? And I'm like, wow, containing multitudes. What is happening? So that's all I'm saying. It's just weird things where you're like, this guy's about, yeah, Hawaiians deserve to have Hawaii again. I agree with you, but then he's other stuff. And I'm like, this is a disaster.
Hawaii, this is a disaster. It's a really good subtitle.
Yeah.
Not Hawaii itself. The way Hawaii, how about Hawaiian independence? This is a disaster.
Yeah, actually, hilarious that you said disaster because before I get into it, it's called Perfect Storms for Disaster.
Oh my
God. Not like one storm, many storms. So,
oh God.
The monarchy of Hawaii was established in 1810 by His Majesty King Kamehameha I after he had conquered and unified the islands after a 15-year struggle. In 1816, the flag of Hawaii was created and featured a Union Jack in the corner. Since Kamehameha I admired and recognized Britain as being an important nation and ally, but it wasn't because they were a colony of Britain. So that is a mistake, people seem to think. Kamehameha is known as the Great not just for unifying the island, but how he maneuvered Hawaii to become a partner rather than a despot of nations who wanted to use the islands as a base before traveling and trading beyond the Pacific. Now, this is me jumping right into modern, quote-unquote, Hawaiian history, because if I were to go all the way back to prehistoric times when the first Polynesian people came up and found Hawaii, and then James Cook and his nonsense, and don't celebrate Valentine's Day, celebrate James Cook getting killed by Hawaiian Indigenous Peoples Day. It's a great episode of Drunk History, I'll just say that, if you want to know more about it. So that's why I'm jumping straight into, from the quote-unquote, the founding of Hawaii as a country, from the Western lens.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's no equivocating about, is this a real country? No, I'm telling you, right here, right now, 1810, it was established by King Kamehameha I.
Okay. Yeah.
So the Hawaiian chiefs believed in keeping mana, sort of spiritual power in the family. They had to keep it in the family. Okay. Kind of like the Habsburgs, who we've met before with that problem. So cousins, marrying half-cousins.
Mm.
For example, Kipe o Kalani was called double great-grandfather or great-grandfather on both sides.
Oh, God.
So this resulted in sterility, stillbirths, miscarriage, developmental disabilities. So that's why Kamehameha I was the first and last king of Hawaii to directly pass the throne to his actual biological son.
Interesting.
So they enacted this sort of informal adoption system called Hana. So you would have it where noble children would be taken in by other noble families and stuff. Because it was more like the attitude of it takes a village to raise a child.
Is this like low-key how Julius Caesar was, yo, Octavian, I am going to adopt you and make you my heir.
Yeah, that's what they did. That's what they did.
I mean, I feel like that is probably one of the more, if you have to go and have that type of rulership, if you have to, quote unquote.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot more sense than you are my bio kid. But what if your bio kid is a shit?
Yeah.
I mean, not that Octavian wasn't a shit, but you never know.
So the Hawaiian kingdom was governed until 1838 without legal enactments and was based upon a system of common law, which consisted partly by the ancient kapu, which is where we get the term taboo.
Oh.
6 months into his reign, Kamehameha II, Liholiho, abolished Hawaiian religion. He did this by breaking kapu when he ate dinner with his mother. It's debated if it was her idea to get more power and rights for women. It was like a caste system that's still sort of semi-operated. But regardless, it was a big deal. The penalty for breaking one of these laws was death, and obviously they're not going to kill their king, and the gods didn't appear and smite him. So that really took away a lot of the everyday cultural laws that had dictated the lives of Hawaiian people, and especially religious laws.
So it's kind of like the way every place has their ridiculous etiquette, because that's what you are and are not supposed to do. He basically broke.
He broke those. Essentially, he didn't want to be governed by the priests anymore and by religion. But then what happens then is this opens the doors to missionaries in 1820.
Oh.
Who are keen on converting people from their religious beliefs to Christianity. In Hawaii, half their work was already done. Since Hawaii didn't have religious leaders who would stand against them because a lot of them had been killed or just were not in power anymore, but they did have to teach Hawaiians how to read the Bible, and the Hawaiian language hadn't been written down. So they had to invent a written Hawaiian language, translate the Bible into it, then teach Hawaiians how to read. They had a huge influence on culture, making Hawaiian women wear little house on the prairie dresses, they're fugly and they're hot, and pushing for outlawing the hula in 1830, since women's bodies moving was a huge affront to modesty and God. So the missionaries show up and they're like, we're here to give you Christianity. And they're like, okay, sure, we don't have anything else going on. But then they're like, everything else you're doing is boo urns. Don't do it.
I mean, no offense to anybody who is really down with Jesus or whatever, but a lot of the people who want to missionary for him, that's just colonialism.
Yeah, no,
it's a different guy.
It's 100%. So right away we have number one, an unstable line of succession. Two, a social and cultural gap left with the abolishment of formal indigenous religious practices. And three, into that gap are missionaries who are conflating God with racial purity, manifest destiny, and other white savior nonsense. In their journals, it was all, we're going into the dark unknown, when really Hawaii had been a major trade center and port since the late 1700s. In 1840, King Kamehameha III voluntarily relinquished his absolute powers and attributes by creating and promoting a constitution that recognized three divisions of the civilized monarchy. The king is chief executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. So already, like I said, we're getting a legitimate, real people government here.
Yeah.
It also stated that the land belonging to its peoples was to be managed by the king. The document also established title property rights, which maintained the lands in the hands of Hawaiian subjects to Malema to nurture and sustain. So I give you this land, but the premise is you have to nurture and sustain it.
What a radical idea.
I know. In 1843, the Hawaiian independence was internationally recognized when the Kingdom of Hawaii entered into treaties and conventions with the following nations: Austria, Belgium, Bremen, presently Germany, Denmark, France, Germany, Hamburg, presently Germany, Italy, Hong Kong, former colony of England, Japan, Netherlands, New South Wales, former colony of England, Portugal, Russia, Samoa, Swiss Confederation, Sweden, Norway, Tahiti, colony of France, United Kingdom, and the United States of America. They are legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Because anything that's not listed there is being colonized.
Yeah, so. Pretty much. Basically, Hawaii is, we are not like all these other places that you're bumping into and taking control of. We are on par with the countries that bump into other countries and take them over.
Yeah.
Okay. In order to protect the Hawaiian lands from foreigners, King Kamehameha divided the lands among the people across the caste distinctions, like I said. So private land ownership hadn't previously existed. In the Great Mahele of March 7th of 1848, reallocated one-third of the land to the monarch, and the other third was allocated among the ali'i and the chiefs and the managers of the Akapua. If you look at the county lines that are in Hawaii right now, those used to be sort of little chiefdom areas. So you would have it where you had the head chief, and then he would manage down to the other chiefs who would then manage the property and then things like that.
Basically mini governors.
Kind of. A remaining one-third was given to the common people. The law required that the lands be claimed within 2 years under the Kulina Act of 1850. Unfortunately, many native Hawaiians made no claims. Mm. So this is how it goes down.
Oh, God.
So the goal was to put more land in the hands of native Hawaiians. Side note, I looked this up and I was, how will we refer to the Polynesian descended people of Hawaii? Because then this gets very confusing about, like I said, who's Hawaiian, who's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying native Hawaiians because that is the designation that they have classed themselves as.
Okay.
So that's why I'm saying it.
Okay.
Okay. But without access to money, land deed literacy, and the cost of surveyors, the land was out of reach to them. This resulted in two-thirds of the land going to sugar plantations who were owned by rich white men.
Of course.
So this was legal, but it was also shady, and it broke apart a collective system where the responsibility and the welfare was less centralized and could be managed easier by local chiefs. So now we're going up the train of bringing it all together, kind of business.
Ah.
The sugar plantation owners soon turned Hawaii into a tropical monoculture of sugarcane, and we all know what happens with a monoculture of one food type. I'm looking at you, Irish potato famine.
Yeah.
Native Hawaiians used to grow taro root, but this land is now being used for sugarcane, and you can't eat sugarcane the same way you eat taro.
No.
So, who are these plantation owners? A lot were the sons and grandsons of those missionaries, because after the business of saving souls is complete, why not go into actual business? Why sugar? Because it's hard to access your sugar plantations when there's a civil war happening in the southern United States, and there's a blockade in the southern Atlantic. The Americans used to get all their sugar stuff from South, and then Brazil, and then Cuba, and Jamaica. But there's a blockade happening because of the Civil War. So how do we get there? We don't. Instead, we'll do it in Hawaii. But who would work on these new plantations? Not Native Hawaiians, because roughly 90% of the population had been devastated because of smallpox, leprosy, and other diseases brought over since the first contact with Westerners in the
1700s. 90%?
Yes.
What the fuck?
Yeah, and leprosy was a particularly devastating. They actually had a leper colony island, like an island that was designated just for people with leprosy.
What the fuck?
So, instead, Chinese, Filipinos, and other Asian laborers were brought in to work the fields, and they slowly intermingled with the population, again, decreasing the numbers of purely indigenous Hawaiians. So technically, when we talk about Hawaiians, you have Native Hawaiians, you have the white people who technically they were born there because they're the sons and grandsons of their first gen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the Asian labor force. They come over and it's just usually men and they find women to be with and then they make families and then those children are Hawaiians.
I mean, it's sort of like what happened with them importing Chinese male laborers to Canada to build a railroad.
Totally. Yeah, it's the same idea. So it's that whole thing of coming into a nation and becoming part of the fabric of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to 1874. It's the end of the line for the Kamehameha dynasty that had been passed from ruler to brother or cousin and whoever was the oldest living male. When His Majesty King Luanalio died without naming his successor, the Hawaiian legislature once again met in special session and elected David Kalakaua to the office of constitutional monarch February 12, 1874. So this is Kaiulani's Uncle David.
Okay.
King David Kalakaua was known as the Merry Monarch. He tried to be a real man of the people, especially for Native Hawaiians. One of Kalakaua's first actions in office was to take an extensive tour of all the islands to greet his new subjects and to bring back the band hula. King David was very interested in the survival of Hawaiian culture, but he didn't want to just stop at Hawaii. He wanted to bring knowledge of Hawaii's greatness to the world. So he set off on an international goodwill tour, taking 281 days to circumnavigate the globe. He went to tiny villages in Europe, imperial courts in Japan and China, the Khedive in Egypt, the U.S., where he met Thomas Edison, and he bragged about how I love to get electricity going on. And so that's why the Ioni Palace was actually electrified before the White House.
Amazing.
Kalakaua was also a man of contrasts. He really liked doing the work of reintroducing traditional cultures and customs, but he liked high-tech and techie stuff, like I said, about electricity. He signed treaties with the U.S., but then attempted to strengthen ties with other countries that he hoped would protect Hawaii from being taken over by the U.S.
Uh-huh.
Because the U.S. was becoming their, slowly but surely, was becoming their major trading partner.
Uh-huh.
But you don't want to have only one trading partner, because one day they'll say, why are we having to pay taxes?
Yeah.
Let's just take you over.
Yep.
There was also the ever-increasing endeavor by Kalakaua to restore ancient Hawaiian social order with customs and ideas of absolutism and divine right, but it was accompanied by extravagance, corruption, and personal interference in politics and the friction of racism. He was trying to compete with other European monarchs and American tycoons to demonstrate his power by spending, and this is all coming to a head.
Of course.
So you can't live that Rockefeller lifestyle unless you're making that Rockefeller money.
Mm-hmm. And all your Rockefeller money potential is being siphoned off into Americans' pockets, too.
Yeah, and every time you write to your government about how you need more money because you need to throw a bomb-ass party, they're thinking, how is this helping our country?
Yeah.
Ooh. So the United States began exercising direct influence over the Hawaiian monarchy with the Reciprocity Treaty of 1875. In exchange for exclusive use of Pearl Harbor near Honolulu, Hawaiian sugar would enter the U.S. markets under favorable tariff rates. Sugar was the island's premier crop, and revenue more than tripled, from $1.3 million in 1876 to $4.3 million in 1880. So we need that money. On October 16th in 1875, a baby girl was born in Honolulu. Her name was Victoria Kaiulani Cleghorn. But more commonly, she was known as Princess Kaiulani Kailani translates to royal sacred one, or the highest point of heaven. Her mother was Miriam Likiliki, who is Hawaiian, and the sister of David Kalakaua and Lilu Kalani. And Kailani's father was Archibald Cleghorn, born and educated in Scotland.
Nice.
So when Kailani was born, she was placed third in line to the throne from her uncle King David and aunt Lilu Kalani. Both didn't have any children of their own with their respective spouses, although they did, like I said, adopt that Hawaiian practice of hanai, which was adopting other children to be like their heirs. On June 30th, 1887, an organization of haole, oh yes, haole is this expression that a lot of white people like to say, like this derogatory towards them, but really what it means is without aloha. So without, aloha is the breath of life, like the spirit.
Yeah.
Haole means you don't have that spirit.
Legit.
So I think it's appropriate to call these people haole lawyers and sugar planters, accompanied by an armed militia called the Honolulu Rifles, part of the Hawaiian League, forced King Kalakaua to sign a new constitution, radically restructuring Hawaiian government. The so-called bayonet constitution sharply restricted powers of the monarchy, limited suffrage to property owners, which had the effect of disenfranchising basically all Native Hawaiians. So they already didn't have any land practically.
Yeah.
And like they couldn't vote now.
Yeah. It's always amazing to me how, again, it's, you have America, which really wants to go and present itself as this liberating, democratizing force. No, you're not really, because you will go and liberate a country if it will go suit your needs. Or, you know, you will go and restrict the suffrage and liberty of another country if you want their sugar plantations.
Well, this is currently right now, this is being done by white Hawaiians, technically. This is Hawaiians who are doing this. They have connections with American business people, but they are Hawaiians. I'll get into this because it's, like I said, it's very complicated.
I'm just gonna go and say though, so it's pretty much no matter what, maybe it's not just Americans, maybe it's just
it's white people. Businessmen, missionaries, and planters rallied to the Reform Party, while Native Hawaiians who met the voting requirements organized the National Reform Party in opposition. So essentially, people were calling for reform because they said the monarchy is corrupt and it's not doing its job. So,
which, you know, fair enough.
Which, you know, that's, but you're a constitutional monarchy. You're supposed to hold into account, work with your system of government. You are the head of state, but you have to work within those limitations. Kalakaua was saying, I would like to be supreme absolute. And they're like, excuse me, you can't do that.
Yeah.
The Honolulu Rifles were affiliated with a group called the Hawaiian League. And this is where the complicated ideas of race and nationality collide. The leader of the Hawaiian League, Lauren A. Thurston, was the grandson of one of the first American missionaries to travel to Hawaii. Many of the other members of the group operated or worked for Hawaii's giant lucrative plantations, the Big Five, including Stanford Dole, evil pineapple kingpin. The Dole Company.
Wait a second.
Dun, dun, dun. I'll get into side note about pineapples and how that's marketing, and pineapples aren't even from Hawaii, so it's bullshit.
Oh my God, I cannot.
Everything you think about Hawaii in terms of on that postcard, it's a lie.
I also just want to say really briefly, though, as a side note, one thing I appreciate about this book, too, it also brought back great food discussion, and I had missed it. Only Isabel had really brought it in a little while, so I was happy for that to be back.
Oh, but the roast pig and everything?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
So these men were white, and technically, based on their location at birth, they were Hawaiian Islanders. But they weren't acting in the interests of Hawaii. They were pro-business, pro-American. Their motivations and methods for passing this constitution demonstrate how they were not Hawaiian in the true sense of belonging to and being loyal to a country, wanting to protect the land and the people. Mm-hmm. They were basically trying to protect their own self-interest.
Yeah.
Which is, remember how I was saying about the attitude of what you were supposed to have with the land, which to, like, nurture and prosper?
Yep.
They don't have that.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and we can't ignore how race plays a role in this insurrection. Would this group of white men have the caucasity to do this if it was a white man on the throne? It's easy just to view this as angry businessmen versus a monarch, but King David Kalakaua was a man of color. He was encouraging Hawaiian cultural revival that threatened the emerging social codes about race that were propped up with junk science, eugenics, colorism, social Darwinism. The Hawaiian monarchy was received and greeted with respect from fellow Western monarchies around the world, but apparently that doesn't count in the eyes of these businessmen.
Yeah, of course.
King Kalakaua was allowed to remain on the throne, with dethroning as a last resort if he refused to obey them. He finally signed the Bayonet Constitution, which eliminated his power and gave voting rights to foreigners, generally Americans and Europeans, by linking the right to vote with property ownership. So you could vote if you owned a patch of Hawaii, but you didn't live there. This is like this shady business, how people will buy condos here, but they don't live here.
Yeah.
But it's a tax haven for them.
Yeah.
Or the Cayman Islands, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That nonsense. Despite this political upheaval, Kaiulani lived a charming life. She lived at Anahau, a sprawling estate in Waikiki, a then pristine rural area east of Honolulu. She grew up enjoying many things. Gone in this book, it's like singing, reading, playing guitar, ukulele, tennis, croquet. She loved horses and horseback riding. Her childhood pony Fairy is real.
Amazing.
But the princess's life was also filled with loss at a very early age. She was 6 when both her governess and her godmother died. And when she was 12, her mother Miriam died on February 2nd, 1887, aged 36. And Kaiulani had the duty to stand at the palace while her mother was lying in state.
Question.
Yeah.
They're really ambiguous about how her mom died, except that we have the, you'll go from here for a very long time, you will never marry, and you will never be queen, yeah, and then she dies. Obviously, that's a little bit of, there's fiction there, but...
That was recorded down that allegedly her mother did say that to her.
Oof.
But in terms of how her mom died, it's really difficult to say because I was trying to figure that out. Did she get sick and they just didn't mention it? But it seems like she just basically went into a decline and then she just didn't come back. She went out walking and she got a chill and she got pneumonia or anything. Like, it wasn't anything like that. So I don't know what her cause of death is. I mean, who knows? You know, people just get something and then they just...
Yep.
Yeah. So from childhood, she was raised with complete awareness of her double race complexity of her culture inheritance, and that the unusual demands would be placed upon her in preparing to become a queen of a sovereign Pacific kingdom, whose indigenous leaders were determined to demonstrate to a Western world that their small nation was as cultured, dignified, and scientifically aware as the so-called great powers. Mm-hmm. Her father wanted her to be educated like a proper young lady, since she was royalty, and it was anticipated she would have important responsibilities to connect with the position. So obviously, she has to go to England, since it's the best when it comes to educating future royals.
Of course.
And
that was sarcasm, by the way.
Yeah, I know. On June 17th, 1889, age 14, Kaiulani was sent to England. When King Kalakaua died in 1891, his sister, Liukalani, proposed a new constitution that would restore powers to the monarchy and extend voting rights to Native Hawaiians. However, Native Hawaiians split between the Queen's National Reform Party and the more radical Liberal Party, who wanted Hawaii to be independent but not ruled by monarchs. But it didn't matter because either way, the Planters' Reform Party held the plurality of seats. Liliuokalani desperately sought to appoint and maintain a new government, but the three parties refused to establish a stable partnership. The Queen's actions angered many of Hawaii's white businessmen, who formed a 13-member Committee of Safety. Anytime white people get together in a group and say it's for safety,
you're on.
Just look out, okay? With the goal of overthrowing the monarchy and seeking annexation by the U.S. On Jan 16th, a Hawaiian marshal, Charles B. Wilson, attempted to arrest the Committee of Safety members and declare martial law, but his attempts were turned down by the government officials, who feared violence. The next day, after a police officer was shot and wounded trying to halt the distribution of weapons of the Committee of Safety's militia, the committee decided to put its coup into action. Near the Queen's Aiolani Palace in Honolulu, the committee's militia gathered and were joined by 162 U.S. Marines and Navy soldiers, who were ordered by John L. Stevens, U.S. Minister to Hawaii, to protect the committee instead of the Queen. Basically, if the U.S. Marines on standby because they're told something could go down, protect the Queen, this whole thing could have ended differently.
Mm.
But because Stevens decided protect the businessmen, a.k.a. our business interests, this is how this happens. The Queen surrendered peacefully to avoid violence, and it's having the National Guard come in to help defend and prop up the rebel group instead of the actual group in power. The Committee of Safety was established a provisional government headed by Mr. Dole.
Pineapple Man.
Princess Kaiulani, who is still in England, learned of the news in 3 telegrams given by Theolophus Davies, her second father, who had been chosen as her personal guardian and accompanied her to England. The telegrams read, "Queen deposed, monarchy abrogated, break news to princess."
Oh my god.
Oh, and I looked this up. Who is this Davies person? Is he sketchy? Davies was the owner of Theo H. Davies & Co.'s, one of the big five sugar companies. I couldn't find anything relating him to the nonsense that was happening in Hawaii while Kaʻulani was in his guardianship, but he obviously had some skin in the game because of what was happening.
Yeah.
At just 17 years old, Kaʻulani sailed to New York to make her own direct appeal to American people for restoration of the government of her people. The heathen princess, the clownish Princess Kaʻulani of pro-annexation skits and cartoons, the backward savage anti-monarchy propaganda merchants tried to paint her as, proved quite a surprise when she traveled across the U.S. following her education. Instead of a caricature, the paparazzi of its day were confronted by an exquisite royal princess wearing the latest Paris gowns and speaking cultured English. So, this is where it gets complicated, because if she wasn't wearing the latest of Paris fashions and, you know, speaking culturally and blah blah blah, you deserve to be given rights and respect regardless of whether or not you're wearing the latest Paris fashions or whether or not you're...
But she wouldn't get it, not just because, you know, she's a woman, but also because she's not white and because we have deeply racist and deeply anti-Indigenous propaganda that was being proliferated at the time and even now, right?
Yeah, well, and if anything, it's just think about the compliments of, oh, she speaks so well for...
You're so articulate.
So well-spoken. So put together. Are you going to finish the rest of that sentence?
I know, right?
Okay. The continual attempts to present all those of Native Hawaiian heritage as illiterate children incapable of ruling themselves backfired whenever the Hawaiian Scottish princess arrived on the scene. As a San Francisco Examiner reporter wrote, a barbarian princess? Not a bit. Not even a semi-demi-barbarian. Rather, a very flower, an exotic of civilization.
Oh,
Princess Kaʻulani is charming, fascinating individual. Yet another reporter would note, she's beautiful. There's no portrait that does justice to her expressive, small, proud face. She holds herself like a princess, like a Hawaiian. I know of no simile more descriptive than of this. Her accent says London. Her figure says New York. Her heart says Hawaii.
Oh my God.
Putting aside this sexist and racist, exoticized garbage... It's true, Kaʻulani was prepared for a time like this, and she showed great character and maturity when she addressed the press pointedly. And I love how they included her speech in the book.
Yeah, I know,
and if you're ever wanting to have a good, eloquent smackdown, just read her speech, because I'll just read the first two lines of it. 70 years ago, Christian America sent over Christian men and women to give religion and civilization to Hawaii. Today, three sons of those missionaries are at your capital asking you to undo your father's work. Who sent them? Who gave them authority to break the Constitution they swore to uphold? Yes! Mm-hmm. Queen!
Well, okay. Princess, but yeah.
Yeah. So from New York, she proceeded to Washington, D.C. She was invited to the White House and met with the president and his wife. No one else had been able to accomplish that. The story of Kaʻulani's advocacy for her people was widely covered in women's magazines of the time. She used the press to win the hearts and minds of American people. She did her best to explain what was at stake in the Hawaiian Islands that they hadn't understood before. And this was a sovereign free nation that's being overrun by insurgents. Uh-huh. So it's not people who are trying to liberate Hawaii. It's people who are trying to take down Hawaii.
Yes.
Just setting the record straight. Shortly after Kaʻulani's arrival in America, a few days into his new administration, President Grover Cleveland ordered the Senate to remove the annexation treaty from consideration and dispatched James H. Blount, the former chairman of the House Committee Foreign Affairs, to the islands to investigate the situation. Over the period of months, Blount concluded a thorough inquiry. And this is where the book ends. Kaʻulani finishes her, I'll show you Hawaii isn't backwards, you ignorant boob tour, and President Cleveland is sending someone to find out what's actually happening. And there's hope that justice will be served, the throne will be restored. But of course, that isn't what happened.
No, I was going to go and say.
And I wrote, after the book ends, all my tears flow.
Mm.
The report concluded that the U.S. legislation assigned to the Hawaiian Kingdom, together with the U.S. Marines and naval personnel, were directly responsible for the illegal overthrow of the Hawaiian government. The report detailed the culpability of the United States government in violating international laws and sovereignty of the Hawaiian Kingdom. See, it would have been different if it had just been that safety committee. But yeah. Because the Marines decided to show up and offer their assistance.
Assistance, quote unquote.
Now the U.S. has really stepped into it.
Yeah.
President Cleveland said he would do everything in his power to reinstate the Queen, provided she would grant amnesty to those responsible for the overthrow. Weak. Eventually, she did have to agree, though, and the new American minister in Hawaii, Albert Willis, assured Dole of her promise and asked them to acknowledge their wrongdoing and resign power and restore the Queen's. They refused, stating that if American forces illegally assisted the revolution, the provisional government would not be responsible for their actions. So why should we apologize? Because America did it too. It's garbage. Hmm. Dole successfully argued that the U.S. had no right to interfere in international affairs of Hawaii on July 4th. So basically, you're not allowed to interfere with Hawaii when I'm now in charge, but you're allowed to interfere with Hawaii
when I'm not in charge.
To help me get in charge.
Of course.
Yeah. On July 4th, 1894, the Hawaiian Provisional Government declared itself the new Hawaiian Republic, but discriminatory policy showed its true nature. First was the disenfranchisement of indigenous Hawaiian and Asian laborers. Hawaiian House elections require voters to be male of at least 20 years of age, speak English or Hawaiian, pay taxes, hold at least 1 year's residency. Hawaiian Senate voters had the same requirements, but residency was increased to at least 3 years and a net property worth of at least $3,000 or an income of $600 was required. The Constitution also excluded royalists from the voting rolls, leaving just 2,700 people able to vote in elections.
How many people were actually living in Hawaii at that point?
I don't know, but I can tell you it sure as shit wasn't 2,700 people.
Yeah. None of this is surprising, to be honest with you. None of it really is.
But it's textbook. If you're ever... It's how to do this kind of dastardly stuff where we're still playing within the game plan lines,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that's what's the most scary, what the hell part.
Yeah. How could they have done this? It was perfectly legal.
Mm-hmm. Except for, I would say, the U.S. intervention in the coup. But the coup, yeah, that's an illegal thing. But now they've set up a provisional government. Now they're making all these laws and they're being recognized.
Yeah.
They're doing it. In 1895, Hawaiian royalists began a coup against the Republic, but it didn't succeed. A search of Liukalani's home found a stash of arms in the flower garden. Let's be real, they were probably planted. Terrible pun, not intended. And she was promptly arrested and convicted of treason. Shortly after this, she was imprisoned at the Iloni Palace, and she found a document of abdication, and she believed if she didn't sign, it would mean execution of her followers for treason. While under house arrest, the queen agreed to formally abdicate and dissolve the monarchy.
Mm.
And there's a beautiful, amazing quilt she made while in captivity,
mm-hmm.
like sort of detailing her story and the story of the Hawaiian people and the monarchy.
Mm.
If you were talking about textiles and things as storytelling, the quilt is incredible to look at.
Where is it located?
Probably at the Smithsonian, let's be real. Okay. Or maybe it's somewhere in the Hawaiian History Museum. I don't know. I'll find out.
Okay.
Despite the unrest, the Hawaiian Republic continued to lobby for annexation in the hopes of boosting their flagging sugar trade. Rebellions are bad for business, and there's no new sugar players on the scene. But America wasn't keen on it because there was a growing population of Asian laborers on the islands, and this would play into later why did it take Hawaiians so long to become officially a U.S. state?
Mm.
Guess what? It was racism. In 1897, Native Hawaiians launched a massive petition to stop the formal annexation of Hawaii to the U.S. They thought if Congress realized that Native Hawaiians did not want to be part of the U.S., they would restore the independence. Public meetings were held on five major islands. In the known population of 39,000 Native Hawaiians, 21,269 people signed that petition.
Holy.
So it's incredible majority since the remaining number of people, they were children. So basically, all adult Native Hawaiians signed this petition saying, do not annex us. So Queen Liukalani traveled to Washington, D.C. to present her protest and the petition to Congress. At the time, a trip of this distance took months, obviously. A quote from the Queen, our flag that was pulled down. The Hawaii Ladies Patriotic Society wrote to Admiral Miller to be allowed for its possession. He never answered. My own flag, the royal standard, was shown to me by a Washington young lady in her drawing room. So the flag of Hawaii that had been taken down was just a look what I got souvenir that was just hanging in some rando's living room.
Yeah.
Sadly, Queen Liukalani's voyage was a fruitless one. Congress had not acted on the President Cleveland's request, and the new Congress had come in with the administration of President William McKinley. By that time, the Spanish-American War was brewing, and the U.S. didn't want to give up Hawaii's prime location in the Pacific. With the explosion of the USS Maine in February of 1898, signaling the start of the Spanish-American War, establishing the Mid-Pacific Fueling Station and Naval Base became a strategic imperative to the U.S. The Hawaiian Islands were a clear choice. This time, Congress moved to annex Hawaii Islands by joint resolution, a process requiring only a simple majority in both houses. On July 12th, it passed, and the Hawaiian Islands were officially annexed by the U.S. Stanford Dole was appointed the governor of the territory of Hawaii, and the Hawaiian flag was lowered and replaced by an American one. The Hawaiian people officially lost their land, their monarchy, and now their independence. Kaiulani, who had by then returned to Hawaii from her long exile abroad, spent the day of the annexation quietly in a somber company of her aunt and other members and friends of the royal family. For Hawaiians, it was a day of mourning. The Hawaiian Gazette reported the details of the ceremony at Iloni Palace, where the Hawaiian national anthem was being played, minus the six native musicians who were excused, all of them so overcome by events they retired and wouldn't play before the lowering of the flag.
Oof.
When battling for their people's independence lost, Kaiulani and Likulani turned their efforts toward voting rights for Hawaiian people. When President McKinley sent a delegation of commissioners to the islands, Kaiulani invited them to a lavish grand luau at her place. She made sure that they were seated between obviously well-educated Hawaiians who were nothing like what they've been told this is what Hawaiians are like.
Yeah.
The hope was once they actually met Hawaiian people, they could no longer pretend that Hawaiians didn't deserve to vote as much as anybody else. 3 years.
And let me guess, that was not successful.
Yeah. We're post-Reconstruction era, but it's But it's more those informal things where you have to pass a literacy test, and your literacy test is recite the entire Declaration of Independence.
Or something stupid,
or something stupid like that. So 3 years after the Hawaiian government was overthrown, a law passed that made it illegal for school classes to be taught in anything other than the English language. English replaced Hawaiian as the official language in government, business, and education. And so began the formal colonization of the indigenous Hawaiian people. Children were punished in school for speaking Hawaiian, and those who spoke Hawaiian at home were ridiculed. This systemic suppression of Hawaiian culture and language took place for four generations, and the language was almost lost due to parents and grandparents who were uncomfortable passing the language on to younger generations. After Hawaii became a republic, Kaiulani's health really was affected. The stress of what was happening, the deaths on people who were close to her, the constant changing of climates through traveling took their toll. She died sadly at age 23 on March 6, 1899. The story goes out she was riding her horse and got caught in a tropical rainstorm. She developed rheumatic fever and never recovered.
Oof.
So there's a poem, I won't read you the entire thing, but it's called The Dirge of Kaiulani by Agnes Rose Soli, as published in the Independent Honolulu, May 13th, 1899. Kaiulani, Kaiulani, princess of the jewel seas. Kaiulani, Kaiulani, sighs the scented tropic breeze. Kaiulani, dove notes echo through the palm fronds and darkling trees. Kaiulani, thy brown nation mourning lowly on its knees. Moans and wails a plaintive cadence, straining sorrow on the leas, and the burden of sadness over reef and ocean flees. Send back our flag. O white men of ambition and power, who robbed our daughter of her queenly dower, relent to her this dark, silent hour. Give us back our flag. And it just keeps going. It's so Victorian. It's sentimental in its language. And it's, you know, they talk about her as like a crushed flower and all this stuff. But I love how it's straightforward calling out white men who did this to her and her country.
Yeah.
And so it's like really poignant and moving. And it's just, it's a lot. You can read it on your own time and sob silently the way I did.
Fair enough.
Kaiulani's father wanted his 10-acre estate that he had spent many tireless hours landscaping to be turned into a park as a tribute to his daughter's life. But the city of Honolulu refused. The land was sectioned off, auctioned off, and now there's a hotel on it.
Of course.
In 1900, President McKinley signed the Hawaiian Organic Act into law. Like former territorial legislation, Organic Acts set aside territorial power. McKinley obligingly nominated Stanford Dole to be Hawaii's first territorial governor. This also gave them more representatives in the U.S. state.
I really want to find out where Stanford Dole is buried and then just dump a rotten pineapple on it.
He's kind of the worst in, like, a very low-key way.
No, like, actually, I'm going to do the rotten pineapple thing at
just
least.
Just, like, leave a rotten pineapple in his tomb. Yeah.
Exactly. It's the least he deserves.
I think so. Though the Organic Act's original intent was to put Hawaii on a path to eventual statehood, few people in positions of power actively sought that process along. For the most part, Hawaiians remained content for more than 30 years to work with the political structure provided. Basically, they said, do you want to maybe be part of this? Like, nah, we're cool. We're doing our own thing. I mean, the people who should be in charge are in charge, so we're good.
Of course.
So do you remember in the book Kaiulani's cousin, Kuiho?
Yes.
Yeah. Age 24, he participated in a Wilcox rebellion against the Republic of Hawaii, but he was sentenced to a year in prison and the others were charged. After serving his term, he left the country and then he came back to fight for the people. He promised to offer legislation for statehood as early in 1910 because Native Hawaiians weren't going to be able to get back their rights through this territorial provisional government crap. So we thought, maybe if we become states, you're a citizen, you automatically get the right to vote.
Yeah. Obviously, Hawaii being an independent country, even now, would be an amazing thing.
But it's like how... But he's thinking, okay...
How do I get to, like, a step towards that?
Towards something where I can at least have enfranchisement of my people.
Exactly.
So, put forward this legislation in 1919, but it didn't, obviously, it didn't receive any support from the sugar lobby and quietly died. In 1927, when asked about statehood, Stanford Dole's longtime ally, Honolulu Observer, publisher Lauren Thurston, same a-hole with the bayonet constitution, responded, "Hawaii needs statehood like a cat needs two tails."
Of course, because it's pretty much their own little oligarchy.
Yeah, their own little fiefdom. Native Hawaiian dissenters were particularly worried that statehood would only allow further centralization of power under the Big Five. Most arguments against Hawaiian statehood pointed out to the largely Asian population on the islands. Opponents insisted they could never be truly, thoroughly, fundamentally, unequivocally American, especially given their suspect loyalties, insular communities, and tendencies to vote in a bloc. So it's not just white people worrying about this. Native Hawaiians also were wary of the Japanese population on Hawaii because it was as high as 30%. Mm. This would, under universal franchise authorized by statehood, organize and vote itself into power to the disadvantage of Native Hawaiians. So basically, Native Hawaiians are, we can't let Asian people become part of the state too, because then they will vote as a bloc and we don't have the numbers.
Even though it's, oh man, we can't go and figure out how to do some coalition politics to go and get rid of the people who are really f***ing us over.
Exactly. But, So fast forward, we're zipping ahead to Japan's surprise attack at Pearl Harbor.
Is Hawaii still not a state at that point?
Hawaii is not a state.
What the fuck? And then they have to go make me care about Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett and it's Kate Beckinsale. And they want me to go and care about that.
And it's not even a state.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Because as soon as that happened, they were like, we can't be worrying about states right now. We got to worry about what's happening here with this major naval area. This is our jump-off part. So Hawaii was actually put under martial law, and it lasted until 1945. Pearl Harbor was the U.S. main forward base for the Pacific War. The Japanese tried to evade in the summer of 1942, but were defeated at the Battle of Midway. Blah, blah, blah. We all watched the miniseries. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as good.
As Band of Brothers,
but we liked it. Hundreds of thousands of American soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen passed their way through Hawaii on their way to the fighting. On the 53rd anniversary of the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, January 17, 1946, Territorial Senator Alice Kamokila Campbell, one of the few voices that opposed statehood for Hawaii, offered her testimony to a joint congressional committee sent to investigate and report on statehood. Campbell testified at the Ohlone Palace in front of a small crowd of 600 to frequent applause. She said, "I do not feel we should forfeit the traditional rights and privileges of the natives of our islands for a thimbleful of votes in Congress. That we, the lovers of Hawaii from long association, should sacrifice our birthright for the greed of alien desires to remain on our shores, that we satisfy the thirst for power or control for some inflated industrialists, politicians who hide under the guise of being friends of Hawaii, yet still keeping an eagle eye on the financial and political pressure button of subjugation over the people in general of these islands."
Amen, sis.
I know, go Alice. But regardless of this, Congress combined Hawaii's statehood bid with Alaska's. Congress decided to grant statehood to Alaska, then Democratic-leaning territory, in early 1959. With a new Democratic state, Congress was now opening then for Republican-leaning Hawaiian statehood to restore political balance.
I mean,
because there's always got to be two, right?
Yeah, well, also it makes sense, too. The crux of republicanism, though, is states' rights, states' sovereignty, and like we're just going to be working in a coalition. They're anti-big government. So I understand why during the 1940s in particular and going into the 1950s, why they would be leaning pretty hardcore Republican, because that's the closest you can get to independence in a state.
On August 21st, 1959, President Eisenhower signed the official proclamation admitting Hawaii as the 50th state, marking the end of over half a century of work of Hawaiian statehood. Statehood transformed Hawaii's economy from a sugar military outpost of an empire to a tourist military outpost. Residential and commercial, predominantly hotel development, encroached on the lands once covered in sugarcane, and Hawaii, with its surfing, luau's, hula girls, and Elvis, was open for business. On November 23, 1993, President Bill Clinton signed a congressional resolution in which the U.S. government formally apologized to the Native Hawaiian people for its own part in what had happened in Hawaii's overthrowing. Unfortunately, it was over 100 years too late for Princess Kaiulani and the Hawaiian people. In that time, lands and waters had been taken for military bases, resorts, urbanization, plantation, agriculture. Since the 1800s, Hawaii has been under siege from missionaries, capitalists, adventurers, and of course, hordes of tourists, nearing 7 million by 1998. The commodification and packaging of Hawaiian culture can't be ignored. The hula, for example, is an ancient form of dance with deep spiritual meaning that's been made ornamental, a form of exotica for gaping tourists. Far from encouraging a cultural revival, as tourist industry apologists contend, tourism has been appropriated and cheapened to dances, music, language, and people, particularly Native Hawaiian women. Burdened with the commodification of their culture and exploitation of the people, Hawaiians now exist in an occupied country whose hostage people are forced to witness, and many of them participate in their collective humiliation as tourist artifacts for the world's rich.
Mm-hmm.
A sovereignty movement still exists in Hawaii's today. Note how I didn't just say Native Hawaiians. Native Hawaiian, like I said, is a classification by the U.S. states. The unmixed indigenous Hawaiian population has still not restored itself to its 300,000 pre-contact level. As of 2010, there's only 156,000 persons declaring themselves to be Native Hawaiian-only ancestry, just over half of the pre-contact level. Though an additional 371,000 persons declared themselves to possess Native Hawaiian ancestry in combination with or with other races, so Polynesian groups, but mostly Asian and Caucasian. The definition of being Hawaii has been led to be expanded beyond genetics. Instead, it ties back to how the original people living on the island saw themselves as people who are connected to each other and connected to the land. The sovereignty movement recognizes that the independent and internationally recognized government of the Hawaiian Islands was illegally overthrown by the U.S. For all the current sovereignty initiatives in Hawaii, the definition of the term sovereignty is simple. The ability of people who share a common culture, religion, language, value system, and land base to exert control over their lands and lives independent of other nations.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's all. Very simple. Dozens of Hawaiian groups have raised awareness of issues like abuses of trust lands, beach access, community control, and the horrible state of Hawaiian health, including categories like infant mortality, obesity, and cancer. Mass demonstrations, legal actions, cultural assertions like building of beach villages or occupation of sacred areas continues.
It's like them trying to go and build a freaking telescope and talk about Mauna Kea. We've lost so many thousands of hours on the sky, and Hawaiians have lost how many years?
Years of their own land uses and independence.
Yeah.
As Hawaiians protest commercial development, they're also organizing to reclaim land base. Land taken from the Hawaiian government at the overthrow, nearly 2 million acres, and awards landed in compensation for military and other takings became the focus of intense organizing. Legal entities, political groups, community coalitions called for some kind of reparation from the U.S. in its role of the overthrow. The example of trust lands is a good case study for the subjugation of Hawaii's. The American Congress allotted nearly 200,000 acres of poorest agricultural lands to Hawaiians under the Hawaiian Home Commission Act of 1912. This was something that former prince turned delegate Kuiho fought for. He said, if you're not going to give them the right to vote, you have to give them land to work at least. So they're fine. We will give you the most garbage land to farm.
Of course.
Obstinately for farm and residential use, the lands were marginal, situated in inaccessible areas, and under development. Additionally, no money was allocated to improve the land. Since its creation, the Hawaiian Homes Trust has been administered first by the territory and then by the state. Allegedly, the federal government has had the oversight responsibility for the trust ever since its inception. You know, Hawaiians are like children. Everything used to be in trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
In practice, the trust lands have been readily available to pool for every use, but that stipulated in the act. The illegal uses for the land, so the American government will just give away the land and oops, was that your land? Airports, military reservations, public schools, public parks, private homes, country refuge dumps. While these illegal uses continue, so too has the rise of illegal applications for lots. By 1999, the waiting list for pastoral and residential lots on the islands of Oahu, Maui, Hawaii, Kauai, and Malakoa totaled over 29,000 applicants. Meanwhile, illegal and non-native uses continued on more than 130,000 of the allotted 200,000 acres. Native Hawaiians are now pushing to create their own nation, seeking a type of self-governance indigenous tribes across the U.S. had established long ago.
Yeah.
Like the Dakota Nation is a recognized nation. Mm-hmm. You know,
Or like how you have like Navajo Nation, which some people, why don't they actually go with their own statehood because it's such a large piece of land?
Yeah, they're recognized as a separate political entity unto themselves. Mm-hmm. Hawaii is the only indigenous people, they don't have that. So even that they don't have. They're like right in this weird limbo thing where they're like, you're not good enough to be, you know, a real citizen, but you're not a real native person. But you're being treated as shittily as a regular native person was. But at least they're part of a nation.
Yeah.
So drafting a new constitution and plans for ratification vote. And you have support from residents all over the island, but as well as the Hawaiian diaspora, far-flung places all over the world. Federal recognition is harshly criticized by some Hawaiians who aspire to strip themselves completely of U.S. law and influence instead of operating within the U.S. system. Remember back in the day, you had the royalist reformers, and then you had the people who were saying, no, we don't even want a monarchy, and we're reformers.
Yeah.
So there's still division in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They want total independence to win an international court order that would call on the U.S. to forfeit its political and military presence in the Hawaiian Islands.
I mean, I say power to that, personally. Yeah. Shoot for the sky!
Yeah, except for, obviously, the key is the military. Hawaii is heavily militarized with nearly 20 bases in the Pacific missile range. All American military activity in the Pacific, where the tensions certainly seem to rise in the coming years, is directed from a base at Oahu. Given the increased tensions, especially with other countries asserting naval ambitions, the U.S. would hardly be willing to let Hawaii go. American military controls over 30% of the populated island of Oahu. Other large land areas on Hawaii, Maui, and Kauai. An independent Hawaii might be able to be neutral, but it could be easily pulled into another country's sphere of influence. Hawaii is intimately tied to the U.S. militarily, as well as politically and economically. It's very difficult not to personify Hawaii as Kaʻulani and vice versa. Frankly, it's patronizing to a nation of diverse people, but it also limits who Kaʻulani was to just a symbol of loss.
Yeah.
Instead of viewing Kaʻulani as an end or an incomplete life, I like to think of her as part of a Hawaiian sovereignty movement. Her legacy continues with the people of Hawaii who still fight for their country to be acknowledged. On opening day at the 2020 legislative session, hundreds of people, many of them Native Hawaiians, gathered at the state capitol rotunda after a year filled with protests, marches, and demonstrations. They registered people to vote, made speeches, hung banners, flags from railings, and held classes in the capitol meeting rooms. On March 12, 2020, the Aloha Ani Party, APP, became Hawaii's newest political party. Founded by three Native Hawaiians, it's founded on traditional Hawaiian values, but it's open and inclusive to everyone. The party's principles include freedom of worship, love of people, protection of the land and sea, reconciliation, recognizing the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom, and the government accountability and transparency. The position of the Aloha Ani Party is Hopo Ana Pono. The essence of this is to make right what is wrong and to restore what was lost or taken. Regarding the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1893, this was a wrong that must be made right for the good of all the people of Hawaii. Only then will pono, balance, and righteousness be returned to the people and the land, and both can prosper. Yeah.
It is a new year, and I am sad.
I know.
Oh, man. The whole thing about Hawaii just makes me don't want to go, to your point, make any place or group of people into a monolith. But I think, I don't know, maybe as somebody who feels very strongly that groups of people should have the right to self-determination and their own sovereignty, even if it might look messy and break apart your ideas of, no, oh, but your part's like, no.
Doing it the right way.
Quote unquote. Nah, I mean, indigenous people across the world should have their sovereignty. And I think that I would be very hypocritical if I didn't feel that way.
Yeah, I know. There's never a nice cherry on top way to end with a story like this that ends so sadly. But like I said, this isn't an end. If you think about it, this is a start. It's always moving. It's always going. We like to just sort of say, here's the beginning, middle, end. But they like to think about things just continuing onward.
Yeah.
And it keeps building. So.
And maybe one day we will stand on the beautiful white shores of a free and independent Hawaii.
Yeah, for real.
One day.
And we won't have a pineapple because they are not native to Hawaii.
No, we will not have a pineapple. Except for the rotten one that we're going to leave on that dude's grave.
Sounds good to me.
Yes.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.